Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is East West Studio Manager Candace Stewart. First of all, Kickstarter, everybody's favorite crowdfunding service, just passed 25,000 music projects that were funded. Just think about that, 25,000 music projects were funded. And still, music projects have the highest rate of conversion of anything that happens on Kickstarter. One of the reasons why music projects work so well on Kickstarter is that the service was created with music in mind. So they have a penchant for making music happen, even though it's expanded way beyond that since then. These 25,000 music projects were done by 22,700 creators and raised $175 million from 2 million people. That's pretty impressive. And when we say music project, what we mean is people that are making albums or raising money to tour or creating labels or documentaries about music or music people or creating new instruments, all of those things. If it has to do with music, chances are it's going to appear on Kickstarter, and chances are it's a pretty good bet that it's going to be funded. It's also pretty interesting that people who have started their projects on Kickstarter have been nominated for 20 Grammys so far. So it just goes to show you that DIY is alive and well, and it definitely does happen in the crowdfunding space. Now, it's interesting in that many musicians, artists, bands think that all they have to do is put up a crowdfunding page and they're automatically going to be funded. And of course, that's far from the truth, because one of the things that's really important to understand is if you don't already have a fan base and if you can't market to them, then no one's going to come to your crowdfunding site. No one. So you have to have that fan base first, and you have to be good at marketing, because it's just not sending out one email saying, hey, guess what? Crowdfund my project. No, there's a lot more to it than that. And a big part of this as well is the fact that the benefits have to be such that the fans will want to give you some money. So you have to think about what they're going to get out of it as well. I have a friend that was doing an album by himself at home. And he said, you know, I'm going to do a crowdfunding project. I said, why? You don't need the money. He says, yeah, I want to get something out of this. That's totally the wrong way to go about it. It's the wrong idea behind it. No, you don't try to make money from your fans. You try to get them to help you create a project. And in turn, they're going to get something out of it as well. So crowdfunding does work. Kickstarter has proven that, in fact, it's very capable of helping any kind of musical crowdfunding project. But you have to go into it with your eyes open and know that if you don't market and if you don't have a fan base, it's just not going to happen. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. If you want to learn more about the basics of mixing, sign up for my 4-week Mixing Primer webinar course. Go to mixingprimer.com to learn more. Also, check out my new Hitmakers Club for access to a powerful online group, all of my courses, monthly workshops and Q&A webinars, core basic training, and much, much more. Go to hitmakersclub.com to find out all about it. Now let's talk about multiband compression. For many musicians, engineers, artists that are doing their own engineering, they find multiband compression intriguing, but don't really know how to use it, so maybe I can briefly clear that up a little bit. First of all, what is a multiband compressor? Well, it's a compressor that splits the frequency spectrum into bands and then compresses them independently. Most of them are 4 or 5 bands, but the fact of the matter is, usually you only need a couple. So when do you use it? Well, if you have a consistent frequency problem with the track, then you probably just need EQ. Where multiband compression really shines is if you have a dynamic problem, so it comes and goes. That's where multiband compression can really come in handy. A couple examples are, you have an acoustic guitar that gets boomy but only on certain notes. Multiband compression is perfect for that. Or maybe you have some cymbals, like a crash cymbal, that sounds okay unless it's hit extremely hard and then it sounds really harsh. Well, guess what? Multiband compression can fix that as well. So the easiest way to set it up, start with one band only. So you start with it, you adjust the crossover point so you only get the band of frequencies that you need, and then adjust the threshold and then the attack and release. If you need another band as well, then you insert that. and maybe a third band, but usually you only need two, from what I've found. Now, one of the reasons why people don't like to use multiband compression is it can change the sound because there's a lot of filters involved, and filters can introduce artifacts and ringing and all sorts of things that just makes the audio sound a little different. And of course, it may control the problem, but at what cost? So as a result, you find that you only need a multiband compressor occasionally. It's not something that you'd use on every single mix. So anyway, multiband compression can be very, very useful. Already there's lots of compressors out there that are only single band. For instance, a de-esser is a compressor that's just in the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 K range. So now we're seeing that the multiband compressor as an EQ is coming of age. Anyway, I hope that now you understand a little bit more about multiband compression. I'm going to do a video on this coming up, and for those that are listening, I'll let you know when it happens. My guest today is one of the longtime studio managers in Los Angeles, Candace Stewart. Candace currently manages the iconic East West Studio in Hollywood, which was once known as Western Studios and was the home of the great Bill Putnam. Prior to that, she managed a number of high-profile studios in L.A. and has worked with major acts like the Rolling Stones, Tom Petty, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Madonna, and Snoop Dogg, among many, many others. We spoke via phone from her office in Hollywood. Let's go back to the beginning. How did you get into this business?
Well, you know, I have three older brothers, and two of them are recording engineers, and they started at the record plant on 3rd Street back in the late 60s, early 70s as janitors. They didn't even call them runners. And I would come out from high school from South Carolina. We're from South Carolina, from Charleston. I would come out in high school and visit them, and they were working with Stevie Wonder and, you know, Ron Nevison and all these people. And I thought, oh, that's cool. But I was going to school in South Carolina. I started college really early. I used to be smart, and I got out of high school when I was 16. And I started, and I was a linguistics major, and then I was a geology major, blah, 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 but I ended up being a psychology major. And so years later, when I moved to L.A. in 1982, and my whole family was already here. And one of my brother Steve Smith, my second oldest brother, had rented one of the old Kendon rooms. He leased it. And this is when he'd gone freelance and wanted to start his own studio. And all the people that had been their coworkers back in the record plant days, like Mike Klink and Gary Ledinsky and David Bianco and Jim Scott and all those guys, those were the first clients that Steve kind of pursued. So I was working in the daytime in the studio, learning how to be an assistant. I wanted to be an assistant, and I was bartending at night. And I did that for about a year. That studio was called Take One, and it was where the old it's where the old Kendon was, which is now, of course, Glenwood Place.
Yeah, I remember it.
At 619 South Glenwood Place. So, I started learning to assist from him, and he was a taskmaster, you know, of that school, that record plant school.
Yeah.
And after about a year and a half of assisting, there were two sessions. One that I did with the late Chubba Petos, who ended up becoming a dear friend of mine. And I was in the room, and I was tape op, and I was an okay assistant. I look back now and realize I probably wasn't that bad. But I was watching Chubba, and I'm like, man, I'm never going to be as good an engineer as this guy. And if I can't be really, really good, I don't think I want to be an engineer. You know. So I went to my brother, and I'm like, I really love the studio, and I want to help you, but I don't think I have the electronics aptitude to be an engineer. And I said, I like doing the sales, though. And I had worked as a bartender and worked for hotels and stuff, so I had that whole hospitality background. And I was like, I love doing the booking. So I met with Rose Mann, who, of course, ran the record plant for a really long time and was a friend and had been their boss. And we had dinner. And hopefully when she hears this, she won't countermand me. But she sold me a phone book of phone numbers, a lot of which were disconnected. but a lot that were valid. And I just started cold calling people. You know, get him to come into my brother's studio, basically.
Wow.
That was how I started.
Wow. Okay, so how long did you do that?
Well, you know, I worked for Steve there for 5 years, and then he ended up moving to Seattle in the late 80s, which was very clever. And you probably remember, and I know, I think this is where I met you, right across the breezeway from Take One was Red Zone.
Yeah.
And Dennis Dager and Frank Reason owned Red Zone. And when they found out that my brother was closing his place, they asked me if I wanted to be the manager. So I said, yeah. And I had already done that. I worked in that complex for 11 years between the two places. I worked at Take One for about 5.5 years, and I think I worked at Red Zone around the same length of time.
I had no idea it was that long. Gee.
Yeah, it was a long time. It was a very long time. And it was like 82 to 93, or maybe it was 83 to 93. But I went to Soundcastle, which you would know, Buddy King.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the owner of Soundcastle, of course, in Silver Lake. And you want me to just give you my chronology?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Sure.
Yeah, so I went to Soundcastle. It was an interesting turn of events when I was on a session one day at Red Zone. I still did a little bit of like pinch hitting assisting here and there, and I was working with Don Was on something, and I got a phone call because, you know, you're doing everything back then. You know, you're running, you're answering the phone. You know, I was doing the payroll, doing the taxes, you know, aligning the tape machine, doing everything. And I got a call from this guy in Orange County named Biff Vincent, and he had this tech named Charlie Watts, not in the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
And they had this English client that was giving him a hard time, and they said, hey, you know, he really needs to come up to L.A. We don't have what he needs here. And I said, okay, yeah, you know, I've got the time. I'll book the time. His name was Tony Platt. And he came up, and he booked a session, and that's how I met Biff Vincent. And Biff Vincent was going to buy Soundcastle from Buddy King.
Yeah.
So Biff went over to Soundcastle and became partners with Buddy, ended up not doing that, but became partners with Buddy, and then called me and asked me if I wanted to come work there. And so I went to Soundcastle, and of course this was when they were really known for doing like rock, and I was all excited because Dave Jordan had just done like Ritual to Habitual by Jane's Addiction, and he'd done Alice in Chains Facelift, and I was like, oh, cool, I'm going to get to go work with this. I had been doing a lot of blues and stuff at Red Zone. I was like, oh, this is going to be cool. I'm going to go do all this like mainstream rock, or it's going to be awesome. And then I got there, and we ended up doing primarily gangster rap.
Yeah, right.
So that's kind of what we ended up doing, and it was very interesting. We had an Eve room and an SSL room, and Buddy and Pat are the nicest people. So I still talk to them today, but they, you know, they had a different background. You know, they were Christian from Orange County, and here are these, you know, all these people carrying guns, and, you know, I'm a 30-year-old white woman from South Carolina by then, you know.
Yeah.
It was interesting, but I actually never had any trouble, really, to be honest. I mean, I ended up being really good friends with all those people, and they were pretty much to a person. They were really lovely. You know, I got to meet Tupac and Biggie and Ice Cube a lot, worked with Ice Cube a lot, and Ice-T, and then, of course, Snoop was real young then. And Nate Dogg and Exhibit and the Alcoholics and East Swift. So all those guys were really young. I mean, I don't even think Snoop was 18. I think he was really young. And so it was actually a fun time in hindsight. You know, it was stressful mainly because, you know, budgets were tight and, you know, there was a whole kind of a mood that was around that early gangster rap that was a bit more intense than the hip hop of today in a negative way. You know, the violent factor with Death Row Records was, you know, pretty scary. But I left there, and I think, gosh, I don't think we had more than a couple grand in unpaid invoices, which was a miracle.
Yeah.
I look back now, and I go, oh, my God, that's a miracle. And then when I worked at Red Zone, I became very good friends, and I'm still very good friends, with an English producer and musician, named John Porter. And John is a wonderful guitar player, incredible bass player. You've heard him as a musician on a lot of Roxy music. And he produced a lot of the Smiths, which I loved, and like School of Fish and stuff like that. And we worked at Red Zone a lot together. We did a lot of blues records like Keb Mo. And, you know, he kind of rediscovered Buddy Guy, and he found Keb Mo, you know, and just helped these people. He just loved the blues, and he's a great player. So he was working on a Taj Mahal record in probably at Piety Street, I think, in New Orleans. And Mark Levinson, who ran cello, had met this guy named Rick Adams. And Rick Adams was a fan, a music fan. And Rick Adams was a very wealthy young guy. He had started UUNet, one of the early internet search engines. And I think Mark is a very flamboyant character. If you don't know who Mark Levinson is, he's got sound systems in cars.
Oh, yeah. No.
The Lexus, yeah.
Yeah.
And he was a hardcore audiophile, actually, and a talented guy. And I think he flew Rick to New Orleans in a helicopter for lunch to meet Taj Mahal.
and said,
"Hey, I want to open a recording studio." And then John called me and said, "Hey, they want to open a recording studio and they want to start a label. I'm going to run the label. Do you want to run the studio?" And I said, "Well, what are you going to buy?" And he said, "Well, we're thinking about buying Sound City." And I said, "Oh, that'd be awesome." And this is in 97, maybe. And I thought, "Oh, that'd be cool." And then he calls me back and he says, "Well, we're thinking about buying 6,000 Sunset." And I'm like, "Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
Let's see." Because I had never been into the Oceanway rooms or Western or United. They were then Oceanway. I had never been into any of these rooms. I think my oldest brother, Rick, ended up starting a rental company with Gary Ladinsky. It was called Design Effects.
Sure.
And he would, in the early days when he was still driving the rental truck, I would go on drives with him. And this is before I ever started the studio. This is way back in the early, late 70s, early 80s. And so I knew of it, and I knew where I was, and I knew of the history, but I'd never been inside the building. And Red Zone, Take One and Red Zone were 70s rooms, built in the 70s. They had the Westlake design, the Hidley design with, the drop ceiling and the cork and stuff like that, and the whole live end, dead end live room thing. And then Soundcastle was a bit of a more modern room. It was the Neve room was a Van Hoff room, and the SSL room was a George Oxberger room, which I still love that room to this day. It's one of my favorite rooms.
Yeah.
The SSL room in the front of Soundcastle. But so when I walked in here and I walked into the building at 6000 Sunset, well, super funny story. So I'm writing my resignation letter. I'm still at Soundcastle and it's on my computer and I'm not ready to give it to them yet. And I come in the next day and they'd open my computer and they'd seen the letter and there was a bunch of tears. And
oh, geez.
I felt really bad. Yeah, I felt really bad because I had, and I love Buddy and Pat, but I wanted to move on. I was going to make more money. That was something, the incentive. But I also wanted, I just wanted to come here. I knew about 6000 Sunset. And so that's what became Cello. And I came here in the fall of 98 and ran Cello till 05. And then Rick decided to close Cello. A lot of people on another conversation with you, I'll tell you the whole story of the demise of Cello. But it had nothing to do with the business or anything like that. It had to do with him and his portfolio, et cetera. Hmm. And so he decided to close it. And that was a very sad day in 2005. And I tried to get a lot of people to buy it because I was very worried that they were going to tear it down and make it a parking lot, which was a possibility at the time. I met with the mayor, who was James Hahn, and LA is not known for preserving their historic buildings, so nothing really happened there. But what happened was my dear friend Doug Rogers, who owns East West Sounds, which is a sample library company, I went to him a couple times and I said, "Look, you're an audiophile, you have great reverence for these rooms, you understand what they are." And I said, "And you record your libraries all over the world." I'm like, "Why don't you just buy the studio and do your libraries here?" And the building needed a lot of work. The building's over 100 years old, and it needed a new roof. It needed lots and lots of work. And I think he just, initially it was like, it looked like a white elephant, like, I don't know if I want to get into that. That looks like it's going to be expensive, and not, be a lot of work. So for about a year, the studio stayed closed and shut down. It was in the receivership of the court because Rick bankrupted it. That's just what he did. He's a Trump-like character in business practice. So he would bankrupt something if it didn't suit his needs, all legally, but just, that's just kind of how he did his business. And so it was under the protection of the court, which was good for a year. So everything was just shut down and all the gear was still in here and wrapped in plastic in here. And I should say to anyone who's listening to this, because I'm back in this building, that's why I'm saying in here. So Doug did decide to buy it, and he went down to court and he bought it. It was basically a legal auction, and he bought it in 2006. And then he went about the task. He's an incredible lover of design. He's really an artistic guy. And he reached out to Philippe Stark, the French designer, and he said, hey, you know, have you ever done a recording studio? And Philippe was going to be here in L.A. doing Katsuya on Vine, and he said, no, but I'm going to be in L.A. anyway. So he came and he looked at it, and together they created the vision, and they fixed all the lounges and the built a kitchen and the bathrooms, and now there's a deck upstairs, and they did all the beautiful improvements, but they didn't change the rooms. And while this was all happening, it took about 3 years. While that was all happening, I was working at Firehouse in Pasadena for Tina Clark, who I admire greatly. She's a producer and hell of a businesswoman. She's a wonderful woman. But so I went to work at Firehouse, and while I was working at Firehouse, you know, Doug was very respectful and kept me involved. And I came and met Philippe, and I would come and talk to them, and I would say, no, you know, you can't take that wall out, or no, you can't change that, because, you know, why mess with anything that Bill Putnam designed, who of course is a designer of Western and United recording as well. So he respected that and didn't change the rooms at all. And then when everything was said and done in 2009, he came to me at Firehouse and he said, you know, you must be bored. I said, you know, I'm not really bored. I love it here. It's a really good job. I love Old Town Pasadena. I'm making really good money and it's really easy.
Yeah.
It's like basically booking one room. And he's like, oh, you got to come back, you know? And I'm like, really? And he goes, well, you know, and so I got him to hire my old assistant, Jen Hilliard. And so he hired Jen, and Jen was here for about a year. And then I think that she just wanted to move on. I don't think it was a right fit, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back and said, hey, you know, this is your chance now or never, because I'm going to hire another manager. And I'm like, wait a minute. What do you mean you're going to hire another manager?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I came back in 2010. And I'm super, super glad I did. And, of course, now instead of being called Cello, it's called East West. There you go. That's the short history on that.
And famous room it is. And it's interesting because you've worked at a lot of different places that have different pedigrees. And I think probably the oldest and maybe the most revered is where you're at now. But that being said, since a big part of your job is booking the studio and actually doing sales, what's different between selling between Firehouse, for instance, and East West, and, you know, going back to Red Zone? What's the difference?
Well, you know, I think it's about knowing your market. And, you know, you and I have both experienced changes in the music industry over the course of our careers, and things are very different. Budgets are very different. You know, video killed the radio star, or whatever you want to call
it. Yeah.
But the real thing is, you know, when you're given something to sell, obviously selling East West in some ways is very easy because it's beautiful. It has the history. It's got the acoustic pedigree. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's a little bit more expensive. So, you know, that's a different market. Red Zone was actually a pretty easy sell. I really kind of came into my own as a manager, I think, there more so even than Take One. The first big project we did at Take One was, you know, Appetite for Destruction, which was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Working with Guns N' Roses and getting a taste of that was great. But, and my brother was a great teacher. He's a wonderful guy. He's still a teacher, actually. And still a mixer. He's up in Seattle now, as I said. But Red Zone was good because, I will say this, and you know Dennis Dager, my old boss. I mean, he was a taskmaster. He was a bit of a, he could be, you know, he could be a strict guy. But at the end of the day, you felt like you were really part of a very small family. And the success or failure of the business rested pretty much on my shoulders. So the selling of Red Zone was easy in some ways because at that time, you know, in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, you needed the overdub studio. You know, you didn't have home studios like you do now, and you needed those, I'll call it a B room, you know, for lack of a better, you know, description. But you needed rooms were in the middle price range, say $1,000 a day or less, because overdubbing was such a long part of the process. You know, so people would be booking weeks at a time for, you know, you track for 2 weeks and you overdub for 2 months, you know what I mean,
yeah,
back then. And,
yeah,
you know, so that was the longest part of the process. So it was about fitting into the market. And, you know, I'm still a pretty aggressive salesperson. I mean, you know, I didn't have the tools that I have now. I mean, the internet's amazing. I mean, now I can look at, you know, I can look at iTunes. I can, you know, back then I did it all. I got Music Connection was invaluable to me. I got the directories from Music Connection. you know, I got the A&R list, and I just cold call people and kind of do what I still do today, which is that, you know, hey, come over, tour the studio, and let me take you to lunch, you know, kind of a thing. And that's always been how I've done it. And, you know, I look at iTunes, I still look at the charts, and I still look for producers and engineers, because there's a lot of new people coming up always, and those are the people that are going to bring you the business, you know. This market and climate is different, you know, with the private studios a lot, but still, same thing. It's the same thing.
What's the mix of your clients now? Is it more classic acts, or is it more contemporary?
You know what? We are all over the map. I mean, it's so, I was laughing the other day saying, you know, I used to think that I could predict the trends. Like, you know, we used to say, oh, it's going to be slow in summer because people are touring, and, you know, it's going to be slow here, but this is good because that's when you can do TV work. In the early years, one thing I do want to mention about Red Zone, I concentrated a lot on advertising work, because advertising work and jingle work was still a very viable option back then. And so you had like Chiat Day and the Daily and Associates, and you had a lot of advertising agencies in Los Angeles. And you had a lot, and because it was in Burbank, you had some that were quite close in the Valley and in Burbank. So, you know, and then you had TV from the studios in Burbank. So I concentrated on a lot of that business, and that was stuff that I pursued because it was, you know, it's just like anything. Is it close to you? You know, is it close to Burbank? So that was good, you know. But here, you know, it's so diverse. We are doing hip-hop. We're doing, I would say that they might be considered more well-known artists for the most part. But that's not really true either, because we're working with people on freshman effort albums as well. You know, we did a band last year, I think, or a little bit longer, a band called Cruella. And I think they're probably going to get really, really big if they haven't already. A girl group, and they're amazing. And I think we did a lot of early work with like Fits and the Tantrums and Foster the People. But we do a lot of hip hop, we do a lot of rock, and we do a lot of scoring. So it's super diverse. I mean, this studio, more so than any other that I've ever worked in, has a diverse clientele. I mean, when it was Cello, it was very, very much the heyday of rock. You know, it was Petty, the Chili Peppers, God bless Rick Rubin. He was a main client of ours and brought me, you know, all the records that he was doing. Mm-hmm. And Jim Scott, of course, and George Jacoulias, and all the guys that work with Rick. You know, but now it's, you know, it's people like Justin Timberlake or the Foo Fighters, but then there's people you've never heard of. You know, there's people that are unknown indie artists, and I'm extremely competitive. So if I have an open day and someone calls me up, I always tell my staff, I'm like, look, when the phone rings, just remember, you two had a first record and so did the Beatles. So that person on the other end of the phone, whether you know them or not, or whether they're famous or not, it doesn't matter. They're still to be treated with the same respect and the same excitement, because, hey, you never know where people are going to go. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Case in point, Guns N' Roses is a classic example.
Well, considering considering that everything has changed so much in terms of budgets, and just the fact that everybody has a home studio these days where they can do their overdubs in, how does that affect a studio like East West in terms of the length of bookings?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, basically I used to have to know 10 working producers. Now I have to know 100.
Yeah.
That's the truth of it. Because people, instead of booking 8 months or 9 months, they're booking 3 days, you know, or they're booking a week. So my job has definitely gotten harder in that sense. Budgets are actually, you know as well as I do, rates are the same as they've been for 30 years, maybe less.
Yeah.
Budgets, it depends on the artist. I mean, I see, certainly the artists are more involved than they were when you and I first started about controlling their own budgets. I think they're probably paying more attention to what they're spending personally as business people. But what's happening to me now is, this year and last year, I hit the ground running in January with two very long-term bookings. I've got a booking that started in December, and they're going to be going to the end of May in one of the rooms. And then, I've pinched myself. That's all I got to say. I just feel really lucky. I've been waiting for the bubble to burst, and I keep thinking that every year is going to be not only my last year, but the demise of the commercial studio. But it hasn't been that, and I'm just so grateful. I mean, I think that what did happen is that a lot of those middle rooms closed, and, you know, now you've got Capital, of course, East West, United, The Village, Henson. You know, you have less studios, so for the people that do want service, and the difference would be, anybody listening to this podcast, the difference is, you know, are you going camping, or are you going to go stay at the St. Regis? I mean, that's kind of the difference.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can stay at your own house. You can stay in an ERT. or you can go someplace where they'll wait on you hand and foot, you know. And I've always been super client service oriented, even at the smaller studios. You know, I think it's all about that because people are paying good money, you know, and it's a hotel of technology. You know, I mean, my attitude still every day is, look, what do they need? How can I get them what they need? How can I make their experience a joyful one? And then just get out of their way, you know, let them make music.
Okay, speaking of which then, is there a type of client that you like the best? And conversely, is there a type of client that you go, oh, God, not them again?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I mean, obviously, and you're an incredibly talented, you know, audio engineer and everything else. So I think you'd know that since I have that background, the client, it isn't so much about the money, you know, that I like or dislike, oh, this person has money or that person doesn't have money. I mean, that's obviously a joy when budget's not a concern. That's great. You know, when you're not being grinded for your rate or something like that, that's great. But my clients are the clients who appreciate where they are, who are excited by coming into work in historical spaces, that get what this is, that they get the acoustics. You know, maybe they're not the most accomplished engineers, some of the guys that come in now, the young guys, but at least if they're enthusiastic and they recognize like that they've been given an opportunity to work on a Trident A-range or to work in, you know, Studio 2 here and get drums, and they go, oh my God, it's so easy. I just put up mics and it just sounds so good. So what I dig is people that are my favorite clients are people that are enthusiastic and excited, you know, respectful, where they go, oh my God, I can't believe I get to be here.
Yeah.
That they did their homework. They went online. They checked out where they were going before they came in. They checked out where they were going before they came in, and they know the history of the studio, and they come in and they find me and they say, I'm so excited to be here. I've always wanted to work here. I've always wanted to work in a real studio. The people I don't care for are people that come in, don't get it, don't get what it is, didn't do their homework, think, you know, don't understand, you know, what enhancement the acoustics and the gear can bring, and then I feel like it's just wasted on them. So that's more concerning to me. You know, if I talk to an assistant engineer and I find out that the people in the room basically don't know their craft, you know, I'm just going to lay that down. I mean, that's more concerning to me than anything if someone's a shitty engineer.
Yeah, if they don't get it, yeah, it's like...
Am I allowed to... If they don't care,
yeah.
You know, if they think that they know everything and then they come into a place like this and they don't realize what the opportunity is to learn and to use the tools that are here, you know, that's the kind of client I don't like. The kind of client that thinks you don't need a good mic. I mean, obviously it's about performance. Obviously it's about the song. And obviously you can make a great record in your house if you're talented. We know that. We also know that a lot of mediocrity has been released onto the airwaves over the past decade, especially in different formats that you and I don't care for. And we'd sit there and we'd go, wow, that just sounds like crap. So, yeah, you know what? Make your only job is to make good audio. You know, when you're an engineer, right?
Yeah, right.
Your only job is to use the tools to make it better. So, yeah, the people I don't like are the people that don't make it better.
What's the
is
most
that fair?
No, that is definitely. What's the most outrageous request that you've ever had?
Oh God, I've had so many. I don't know. Is this an R-rated program?
Yeah, you can go there. Sure.
It's not. It doesn't seem outrageous to me, but to someone who's listening to this, it might seem unusual to have to, you know, procure, you know, a hooker or to go score drugs for somebody. That might be outrageous to the listening public, but certainly wasn't outrageous and definitely wasn't unusual in the early days of my career. Now it's silly things, you know, like It's something, you know, it'd be goofy stuff, like a rider where they want a certain kind of kombucha or some kind of crazy water. I think my craziest request, and hopefully he won't hear this and no one in his camp will hear this, was Elton John back in the cello days, and I had to pick up 100 hot pink lava lamps. And I love Elton John. You know, I'm crazy about him. I think he's amazing. But so I didn't have the runners do that. I drove around personally myself and went to every store that I could find to pick up these lava lamps. And then each day, this is the crazy request. There was a request for a flower arrangement that was a life-size Rottweiler on a hill with a cape. This is also for Elton John. With a cape, wearing a pair of sunglasses. And Pat Leonard was a producer on this. Pat Leonard's such an incredible talent.
He's
unbelievable. I revere Pat. And I don't know whether it was Pat's request or Pat's idea or Elton's idea, but we made it happen, and we had it made, and it was wheeled into Studio One, and it was on a pallet about 8 feet by 10 feet, and I was standing in the room by myself, and I was looking at it going, and I said, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
And I was just like, that's just crazy. And I turned around and Elton John said, what is that? And I went, oh my God, I can't believe you're standing here. And I was like, I'm sorry. He goes, no. He goes, I feel the same way. He goes, I can't believe that you guys got that for me. He goes, and thank you so much. So that was an interesting story. The Rottweiler, the life-size Rottweiler on a pallet with a cape that said Elton John on it. That was probably my most strange request from a customer.
That's awesome.
To get a miniature float.
Yeah.
I think that was the hardest thing I ever had to procure. You know, hookers and drugs are a lot easier than that. And that's all I'll say.
Okay, last question.
Sure.
In your travels, what is the best piece of business advice that you ever received, or maybe something that you learned along the way?
I think something that I learned along the way, and it might have been from my parents or it might have been from somebody else. I can't say who it would be from, but I think that, you know, again, treat every client the same. You know, treat every client like they're just as important as anybody else. And treat every client as if they're going to be the next Beatles or the next U2, because you know what? They might be.
That's great advice. And certainly, I've been in situations where, with a small budget, I was treated like I had a small budget. Didn't make me want to go back
there.
So.
Yeah. Well, no, and it's rough. I mean, the only time I think I've ever gotten harsh with clients or been less than gracious, I mean, I am Southern, you know.
Yeah.
Been less than gracious was if someone was trying to rip me off and they were rude about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if someone came to me and said, oh my God, the money didn't come in, I don't have it, I promise I'll get it to you. Like, I mean, still to this day, I'm kind of a sucker. You know, if I like you and you're polite and you seem like you're really trying to get the bill paid, I'll be fine. You know, I might even let you keep working a little bit. You know, there comes a point when I make you stop because I just don't want to get in trouble. But I think that if you're rude to me and then you start to act like I'm the asshole because you're not paying or you're being abusive to my staff, you know, that's the other thing. I've had a lot of leeway with the people I've worked for. God bless all of the people I've worked for because they've left me, you know, they've let me do my thing and they've left it up to my discretion. And if somebody was rude or disrespectful or was going to get physically violent with my staff, I had never had a problem kicking people out.
Yeah, good.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's been rare. It's been rare. You know, I think I'm known to be benevolent, you know, but it's happened. It's definitely happened where I've grabbed people by their shirt and pulled them outside. I mean, I got a redneck streak, so you know, I don't want anybody to hurt my staff or to hurt my gear or to hurt my studio or to anything like that. I hate rudeness.
I think that's my
biggest pet peeve in the world.
One last question. Do you have any advice for a studio manager that's just starting out?
Yeah, I do actually. I would say go to shows. You know, go to shows, give out your card, you know, give, even if you're in a tiny little studio, and especially if you're a studio owner, manager, you know, engineer, and you're trying to do everything yourself, go to shows. Go to local shows, get cards, give them out, meet with the band after the show, because I still do this with my runners. I still have my runners go to shows and come and bring me bands if they think they're cool, because you never know when there's going to be an open day or an open week or something, and you can get somebody in, give them a good demo rate, and, you know, get. But for me, it's about filling the time, but at the same time, it's about them learning how to network and them learning how to get business, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, my advice is don't be a snob. Don't think you only need to know the most successful, famous managers, artist managers, engineer producer managers, or producers. Get down there on a grassroots level. Go to clubs. Keep in touch with the music that's happening in your town. Now, these days, I'm a little older, so I usually just go to dinner. But I do still go to shows. And I mean, and that would be, and I think that was my strength during the Red Zone days and the Take One days, is because I would go to, remember when Lingerie was open, you know,
sure.
The Club Lingerie? I would go to clubs. I'd give my card and I'd say, hey, I'm the studio manager. If you ever need any studio time, you know, you just please call me and come see the studio and I'll be happy to work with you, you know.
For more about Candace and East West Studios, go to East West Studio. That's all one word, East West Studio.com. Thanks for listening and being my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.